Accession number 20523, Reel 1.
June 21st, year 2000, and I'm at the home of Mr. L.C. Haynes. Can we have your full name, your date of birth, and how old you are today?
Leslie Crowther Haynes. I was born on the 24th of October 1919, and today is the 21st of June of the year 2000, so that makes me 80. And looking forward to a long and happy retirement.
Now, you were at Dunkirk. Can you give us the dates and exactly what happened to you there?
Well, I wasn't actually at Dunkirk. I was still in France when Dunkirk took place. I joined the RAF in early 39 when they formed a unit of the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve. We used to go over there once a week for training. And we were designated aircraft hands, second class, general duties. And when the war started, we were called up, and I went up to Felton, just outside Bristol, Gloucester Gladiator planes and all that sort of thing. And we were there until January 1940, and then some of us were posted to the Forward Air Ammunition Park at Nogent-le-Besse in eastern France, somewhere very near to Epernay and Reims in the Champagne area. So we set off from Plymouth and went to Southampton, over to Cherbourg on the ferry, and then by train to Paris, and then on eventually to Reims, where we were picked up by a lorry, and that's where we were. And we were the Forward Air Ammunition Park meant we kept all the bombs and ammunition for the RAF in France in 1940. There were ferried battle squadrons and a couple of fighter squadrons there, and a lot of them were up near Lille, which wasn't too far away, but there we were. And as aircraft and general duties, we used to lug these things around, the bombs, load them into lorries for the various places and squadrons, etc. And we also had Lewis guns, old-fashioned Lewis guns, around the perimeter of the bomb dump. They were to protect the bomb dump from any air attack. Of course, it was what they called a phony war. And we were always remember we used to go into Reims for concerts from ENSA, and I think the night before the war, May the 9th, before the war actually started, there was a concert in Reims. I think it was Nakanella and his Georgians, but I'm not quite sure, but I think it was.
Not everybody has fond memories. ENSA, every night something awful was one of the things.
Yes, they did say that, didn't they? Yes, I've forgotten that, yes. Oh, I suppose they did a bit. they tried to entertain us, and yeah, we used to go, it didn't cost very anything. So we came back to camp that night fairly late, and we used to sleep in our shirts. We didn't have any luxury pajamas out there in those days. And at dawn, there was loud bangs and things, and we suddenly realised something was going on. So we got
what
out in our shirts. And that's May the 10th, 1940. Always remember that day. And the war actually started, and the I always remember going out to the door in my shirt and seeing this airplane flying by low with a black cross on it, and I realised it was a German aircraft. I couldn't believe it. And we ran out to the Lewis guns and slapped they used to have a drum with the ammunition, slapped the drum on and blasted away at anything that moved in the air. Well, I don't think we did very much, but still, we did it. And we were there then, and supplying us ammunition, and we realised upon the stories we were heard and the refugees that started coming back that the Germans had got through the Maginot Line and things weren't looking too good. Now, amongst the bombs and ammunition that we had stored there, we had some tubes, they were like drums with a tube sticking out. They were called smoke curtain insulations, SCIs, and these were slung up under the wings of the ferry battle aircraft. They would precede a tank attack. That was a theory, anyway. And they would spray smoke in front of the tanks to protect them from enemy fire. But the ones that we had, some of them had been filled with mustard gas. And when we queried this, they said, that's just in case the Germans started using it. And if they got to know we had it, that we would deter them from starting gas warfare. So we had them. Now, as the days went by after May the 10th, we began to realise, I was only 18, 19 at the time, that things weren't going very well, and there were lots of comings and goings, and eventually, nine of us, there was a sergeant and eight airmen, with a couple of lorries, we had to load up these smoke curtain installations that contained mustard gas into one lorry, and we all climbed in the other, and we were told we were going to Paris, where the RAF were flying an aircraft over to land, and we were going to load this mustard gas into the aircraft, and if there was room, we would all get on board and be flown back to England. They said the idea, of course, is that no way must the Germans find that we've got mustard gas over here. We must get it back to England. So this sergeant and us, we set off, and the first night we had to stop, I always remember we drove a lorry into a little wood, and we all laid round the edge of this wood. All we have is rifles now, in case of airborne attack from German parachutes. But of course, nothing happened. And we next day we went on to Paris. And when we got there, we went to this aerodrome. I don't know which one it was. I was didn't know Paris well, probably Orly or somewhere. And I do know that when we got to the entrance, they wouldn't let us in. And the sergeant came back eventually and said the runways have been blocked by lorries so that no aircraft can land. So there was an RAF officer there who was a dental officer, yet he had a gun in the holster around his waist. I always remember it because I always thought dental officers and doctors didn't carry weapons, but he did. And he sort of took us over, and he said, we're going to go to Brest, he said, and get rid of this mustard gas down there on a boat. So we got some rations from, from the NAFI or somewhere, and off we set again, and we stopped several times, and we couldn't make very good progress because the refugees were getting more and more on the roads so that we couldn't progress, and every now and then there'd be a scare about parachutists. And we used to stop at night and billet down as best we could. And we'd heard that a lot of the troops had been taken out of France through Dunkirk to England, and we felt as though we'd been left, so we were anxious to get to Brest. And we got along Brittany in the night. I don't remember where exactly, but I think it was somewhere near Le Mans, when we were stopped by some British soldiers who said, don't go this way, the Germans are down there, they've landed a lot of parachutists and they've taken it over. And if you look, you can see it burning and you can see the red glow in the sky. They said, we think that is Brest. Oh. So we had a conference and the officer said, we've got to get rid of this mustard gas. If we get caught with this, we'll probably get shot. So there was a lake nearby, and on this lake was a couple of boats. And we got a boat, and we loaded the SCIs into the boats, took them out into the middle of the lake and tipped the things over so that they sank in the middle of the lake, and we got rid of all the mustard gas. And I don't suppose I've ever had a fish in that lake since. I don't know, not quite sure what it was, but no doubt it didn't do the fish population any good. We then went back to our lorry, and the officer said, well, we're now going to get down somewhere on the coast, Saint-Nazaire, La Rochelle, somewhere down there, and see if we can get out. So we started off, and remember we stayed in near the town of Tours and several places I didn't know. We stayed in Slept Rough, Sometimes we were lucky and got into a barn. And eventually we got to Nantes. And we skirted Nantes and headed to Saint-Nazaire. And when we got to Saint-Nazaire, we were told that... well, I wasn't told because I was in Leonard, but the officer said that he thought we could wangle the passage to England because there was a little freighter in the Saint-Nazaire harbour with an Indian crew, a Lascar crew, with a couple of Dutch officers, and they weren't willing to take us and some soldiers who were also in the same boat to England. And so that was due next day, so we could see this big ship out in the bay, outside Saint-Nazaire. We wondered what it was. And what we did then, we smashed the sumps on the lorries, destroyed the engines, and pushed them off the quay into the docks at Saint-Nazaire so the Germans couldn't use them. And the soldiers had produced some Johnny Walker, bottles of Johnny Walker whiskey, and we had some biscuits. And that was about the sum total of what we had. And about 30 of us got on this ship, which was in ballast, just sand in the hull, in the hold. And we set sail. And we were told we were heading for the Scilly Islands because the German aircraft and ships were in the channel and we had no chance of landing directly in England. Anyway, as we came out of Saint-Nazaire Harbour, we could see some German aircraft. And I always remember we all got our rifles and went round the deck of this ship, crouching behind the bulwarks. The idea of shooting at these aircraft if they came towards us. But they weren't interested in us. I was going to say, thank God, but I suppose that's not the right way to say it because of what the damage they did. They went for the Lancaster Castle. And I believe about 4,000 poor devils were killed when she sank. But it did take attention from us, and we were able to slip out of Saint-Nazaire without being attacked. And we went in and went up the coast of Brittany behind the islands, and we eventually got to Ushant and started to cross towards the Scilly Islands, we thought. And we saw this aircraft come in, and we were game. We all got round, as we always did, with our rifles ready to shoot at it. And we suddenly realised it had round things on its wings, and it was a British aircraft. A flying boat, and we all waved our hands and cheered. And I don't know what took place, if anything did, on the radio, but we then, after three days, we landed in Falmouth. We didn't know it was Falmouth at the time, but when we got in there, we found it was Falmouth. And as we got in alongside the quay, we could see loads of soldiers with some without coats and some with bandages on their heads. And the women were coming down with pasties and jugs of tea. And apparently the Lancaster had sunk after we'd left. And so some of the survivors had been picked up and brought back to Falmouth direct. They hadn't made the devious passage that we made, and they were there. So there was a gang of us there, and the Falmouth ladies were wonderful to us. We had... they gave us food, sandwiches and pasties and things. And eventually we were told that they were going to arrange a special train to take us all up to London to be dispersed. And I, having been on the railway, one of the chaps I saw on Falmouth Station when we were waiting for this train was a railway inspector. And he said, "Oh, my God, Les Haynes," he said, your father thinks you're dead." He said, "My God, you're here." I said, "Yeah." So he said, "I'm getting on to him." So he got on the telephone to Plymouth, and we got in this train. And when we started off, we didn't know this, and away we went. And then the guard came along, and there was only 9 RAF men. He said, "One of you, Les Haynes?" I said, "Yeah, me." He said, "Right, I've got news for you." He said, "This train is stopping in Plymouth Station." He said, "Look out, your father and mother's going to be there." And there's another chap on from Plymouth called Lane. His father and mother are going to get them there as well. So there we are, the train stopped with the dozens of soldiers in and us few airmen, and they're on the platform as well. Well, you can imagine the scene. They thought we were dead and gone. But there we were, and we were back in Blighty. And, well, when you look back on it, we were very, very fortunate, I suppose, to get away with it, because the constant flow of refugees, and you could see by what the condition they were in, what some of them had been through, and we knew that parachuters were being dropped here and there, and it was a pretty traumatic time. Well, during that journey from Paris to Saint-Nazaire eventually, which took us a couple of weeks, I developed a very sore throat. I always remember, and I went to this, and I said, I can't hardly talk to this dental officer. I said, can you help me? He said, well, there's two things. He said, one is you can lay down here beside the road, he said, and if you wait long enough, the Germans will be along, and they'll put you in hospital, or they'll shoot you. Or he said, the other thing is, all we got is some salt, he said. If you put salt in water and gargle with it, that's the best thing you can do. And he was right, I gargled with it. My God, the throat was gone within a day or two.
This was all pretty exciting for a Bill Cream boy, who was just an irk.
Yes, thank goodness me. Yeah. Yeah. We were unwashed and unshaved, and I don't know what my mother thought about me when I got to know. But because we hadn't eaten properly, we hadn't washed properly, and you can imagine all these soldiers on this little boat with one toilet. You can imagine it wasn't too good. But we got there, and we were actually dropped off at the RAF out of depot at Locking, just outside Westminster, and we went in there, and they re-kitted us and spruced us up, and then I went up to Oxbridge to a depot there, RAF depot, and was then posted to Bomber Command, and I was then on Bomber Command for many years. And incidentally there I was, they started to form the Air Sea Rescue Service, because many of our air crews have been drowned by dropping in the channel, and we had no real system to pick them up. So they asked volunteers, people who knew something about boats. So I said, well, I'm a member of a yacht club, and I've always been in boats. So they said, just what we want. So off I went where is it up in Scotland? Stranraer, where they were training the first batch of air sea rescue. Well, I've been there 3 weeks. I didn't like it pretty much, because it rained all day and the pubs didn't open on Sundays. And they were teaching me how to row. Well, I could row before I could walk almost, but you had to learn to row their way. And then the CO sent for us and said, Mr. Haynes, you're an armourer now, aren't you? I said, yeah, I passed out as an armourer. He said, right, your duty is to go back to Bomber Command. Mr. Churchill is going to start 1,000 bomber raids. He said he wants every man who knows anything about bombers and bombs and anything associated with it back on duty, because it's maximum effort. So, well, what could you say? Well, away I went back to Bomber Command, and I stayed on that then till the end of the war.
You must have seen some of the tragedies of so few returning after so many went home.
I'm no hero, but I did think that if my eye would let me, I damaged my eye when I was a boy swimming. Somebody threw a stone at me and just splashed me and hit me in the eye. But I thought if I could get away with that, I would like to be air crew. But I was on Bomber Command.
Were you worried about the morality of the thing?
What, bombing?
Yeah.
Yes, it did trouble me a bit, I must confess. But then I saw what they did to Plymouth when I came home on leave. And one begins to get a bit, revengeful, I suppose. But, when you think of, you know, when you've seen women and children in the London Underground laying on the platforms trying to escape bombs and things like that, you think, what a sort of life, you know, what's the matter with us?
You would have liked to have been air crew, though.
I would have liked to. I used to, as an armourer, I used to go up and fly around with them sometimes when they said their gun turret wasn't working properly or things like that, and we used to do that. But it became very apparent very quick that if you were air crew and used to do a tour of duty of 30 flights, if you lasted the 30, you were considered very lucky. And
did the men you meet, were they neurotic as a result of this?
Some were. Not Most were, well, I wouldn't say philosophical, but they've accepted their lot, I think. But some were very worried, and that was, again, a job we used to get. And they would come back and without dropping their bombs and or jettison them on the way back. And they said that the rear turret wasn't working, so they didn't go on. And then we had to go up and test the turret. We used to find the turret was perfect. It was just an excuse to...
So there was some very understandable cowardice. There must have been.
Oh, yes.
By the nature of things.
Yeah. It was a beastly job, and...
You must have had the job of clearing up some of the damage in the aircraft with bodies, and presumably?
Well, not with bodies, but we did the damage. I got the mention in dispatches.
Did you?
I've still got it.
What was that specifically for?
Well, one of the things we used to get involved with was unexploded bombs and ammunition and mines. Now... if a farmer, an aircraft, jettisoned his bombs, one of our aircraft, over a farm, for instance, we would have to go out and dig up the bombs, and we would then make them safe. But as the war went on, the anti-handling devices, if you like, became more and more sophisticated and more difficult to deal with. For instance... we started, my last squadron was Stirlings, and we used to do a lot of mine laying in the English Channel and off the German ports and the Dutch and Belgian ports. And these mines, of course, the Germans would know we'd drop them, so they would sweep. And so then we used to put things in, like a clock which you could set, so that you could sweep it 6 times and nothing would happen. But the 7th time, they would explode, well, in the hope that... by the 7th time, a boat would be passing. Well, these, and there was another anti-tilt thing, which is had a dial with a needle, and if you moved the bomb and the needle touched either end of the dial, then the bomb would blow off. And so, in other words, you couldn't lift it with a crane unless you were very, very careful and knew what you were doing. So we had to go out and deal with this. And one of our aircraft loaded with mines, crash-landed on an American aircraft this was in East Anglia. And they didn't know what to do with it. It was there, loaded with mines. And we had to go out and get these mines off the aircraft and then make the mines safe. And so this is what we did. And you had a bunch ran in and you knew how to neutralize the anti-handling device and the timer you could switch off if you know where these sort of things, and that's what we did. And I always remember it. I was a corporal then, and I had a couple of a leading aircraft and an aircraft from second class with me on this job with this aircraft on the American aerodrome. And the three of us, well, it was dodgy because we had to get the aircraft up on crane and then... I released the bombs, so when the aircraft was lifted, the bombs were left on the ground. And they dropped one or two of them. I can tell you we were all, you know, a little bit worried about it. But anyway, they did, on the turf. And then we went in to render the bombs safe, and we did that. And then we loaded them on a lorry and so on. But after that, the CO sent for me and said, you're going to be mentioned in dispatches, Corporal Haynes. I said, oh, yes. He said, and so is leading aircraftman Evans. I said, oh, yes. What about aircraftman so-and-so? Oh, no, we can't give him one because we've only got a certain allocation this month, and that's it. We've used it up.
So, that was all that had come up with the rations.
Yes, that's right. I always remember that. There was only two of us got mentioned as badges. The poor old third one didn't.
But in a way, that must have been as nerve-wracking as taking part in a bombing raid.
Well, yes. You tried not to use your imagination too much. It was... it was a bit dodgy, digging up our own bombs. And we met some very funny things. When I was at Chebra, which is in Suffolk, and the people there were very superstitious. They used to throw frog bones onto a stream. If they went with the stream, all was well. But if they went against the stream or went straight down, then there was trouble. I don't quite know, but there was all sorts of things like this. And there was a chap building a house for himself, doing it himself, and he used to do it on Sundays. And I always remember the farmer's wife saying, "He'll no good will come of that. He's working on Sundays building that house." And of course, sure enough, one night we were going off on a raid on our aircraft, and one of them crashed his, on takeoff and ran right into this house and totally demolished it. And they all said, "Well, there you are. We told you no good was coming of that."
Now, did you have any knowledge of the inaccuracy of the bombing? I mean, we hear now very few of the bombs did what they were intended to do. They either didn't explode or they were miles off target. Do you have any knowledge of that?
We used to be able to go and see the footage because they were all equipped with an automatic camera. And we used to go and see some of the photographs. And, well, it was obvious that they weren't dropped on towns. Some were dropped anywhere. And who can blame the pilots and the aircrew, really, when they knew what they were going into? It must have been very, very frightening.
So are you saying that they deliberately didn't attack the targets, or it was misadventure?
Well, I can't say that.
A bit of both, wasn't
it? We suspected that anyway, that they were dropped and jettisoned the bombs and then come back again. And who can blame them, really? All right, some people got no imagination or something, I don't know, or at least a sense of duty and go on. But there are bound to be weaker people who... Oh, no, I don't think I can carry on. And they jettison their bombs. And, well, as I say, I've seen some of the... We used to see the photographs after a raid, and it was obvious that quite a few of them hadn't reached their targets. Let's put it that way. Yeah, hadn't got there. And, well... In the end, we were doing a lot of, funnily enough, Yugoslavia from Chebra, or towards the end of the war. We were flying most of our missions, our aircraft were doing, weren't bombing at all. We had special containers, which we would put in the bomb bays, and each container would have supplies for the partisans in Yugoslavia. And... on the outside was strapped a special tool with a... A tool with a spade on one end and a pick on the other, so that as soon as they found it, they could get the tool off and dig a hole and bury it before it was discovered. And we did a lot of this to the Yugoslav partisans. In fact, when I went to Yugoslavia after the war, I often wondered whether any of our stuff was there anywhere. But
you had a pretty exciting war then.
Well, yes, I suppose it was very interesting in lots of ways. It when I saw what went on in Plymouth, I knew the folly of it. But what else could you do? Really, it was you were in a cleft stick. It caused the death of my mother in 1943. The house was bombed in 1941, and she never got over that. And you come home on leave. So sometimes you're glad to get back to the station again.
On a personal note, my father was in the First World War and was badly gassed and had frostbitten toes through serving in the trenches. And in the Second World War, he was in hospital and that was bombed and was evacuated and died of pneumonia.
Well,
so gassed in one war and bombed in the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, surprising. I was said originally when we went to France, we were in Nogent-le-Besse. Now up around that area, there were whole areas of derelict-looking land with trees and that, and there's a sign of Danger de Mort. And we were curious what this was, and then we found they were First World War trenches. And laying in the grass, you could actually see shells that presumably had been fired and not exploded. And they've been dug up since, I don't know. But you could actually see some shells there. And there was quite fairly extensive areas like this around that part of France. And
on a personal note, I went up to Jesus College, Oxford, after the Second World War. And they were demolishing some old chemical laboratories and came across some gas tanks which was, they'd been used for experimental gas in the First World War, and they didn't know what to do with them, so they took them out onto one of the college farms and let the gas off and killed five cows.
Oh,